This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello and welcome to Books of the Year. It's another podcast from your friends at Books of the Year.
I like the pause there between books and of the year.
I feel it's a new thing. Yeah, if I give it different emphasis,
yes,
freshens things up.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Every single time.
Yeah.
I'm quite excited about today's podcast.
Yes, this was a book, I think, did you get this for Christmas or something?
Yeah, well, what happened? I know you are very dismissive of my presence on Blue Sky social media.
Yes, yeah.
But I actually did, I don't know what you say, I blue skied a thing about the fact I was interested in reading about books of the English Civil War period.
Okay.
Did anyone have any recommendations? So a bloke called Peter Jones says, about the 1650s, rather than Puritanism per se, try Anna Kay's The Restless Republic. So okay. I bought it and devoured it and thought,
yeah,
this is fantastic.
And you were quite right to say that. It is fantastic.
And so Anna will be, hopefully, with us to talk about her fantastic book, which hopefully everyone else loves as much as we do.
I'm sure they do.
Stephen on the Wirral, first of all. Simon and Matt, I'm a big spy and espionage fan and have loved some of your recent fiction recommendations from the likes of David McCloskey and Louise Doughty. I wondered if you'd come across the writer Charlotte Filby, granddaughter of Kim Filby. One of her most recent books, Edith and Kim, is really good, and I thought I'd recommend it to you and your listeners for anyone who wants a good spy story. I, for one, couldn't put it down, but then it did tick an awful lot of boxes. Based on a real-life event? Tick. Twists and turns? Tick. Great writing? Tick. I look forward to what Charlotte publishes next. That's very interesting. I didn't know about
yeah,
that.
I don't know who Edith, because I read a book about Kim Philby last summer, written by a friend of the pod, Ben
McIntyre.
Ben McIntyre.
Thank heavens you didn't call him Ben Ding Dong. Which is what you normally
would I would have done. But I can't remember who Edith was in that. But anyway, yes, that would tick some of my boxes as well. This from Clucky Hen, Simon and Matt. I love Kylie Reid. What a brilliant, innovative, important writer. I've devoured Come and Get It already and just want more from her. Thanks for a great interview, says Clucky Hen.
She, Kylie Reid, recommended Heartburn, the audiobook, written by Nora Ephron and narrated by
Meryl Streep.
That's the one.
Ding Dong, yeah.
Meryl Streep, that's right. who in the adaptation of the movie, in the adaptation of the book, in the movie, the main woman is played by Meryl Streep. So there's a connection there. And it is fantastic. So I only downloaded it because of what Kylie told us.
Yeah.
And I thought she was absolutely right. It's a fantastic performance. It's $11.99, which is quite steep for an old book, but then it's Meryl Streep.
It is Meryl Streep, isn't it? Audiobooks don't tend to get sort of discounted either, do they? They tend to always be rather expensive.
Maybe they've got a lot of money to pay Meryl.
Trying to catch up. Charges.
Booksoftheyear@yahoo.com is the way you can send us an email. We are on Twitter at Books of the Year, on Instagram and Threads at Pick Any Page. Not on Blue Sky, but.
Not on the Blue Skies yet.
But if anyone else is on the Blue Sky, then get in touch.
Yeah, do get in touch.
Because
with
it's quite lonely.
Simon,
me and Peter
Stephen
Jones.
Fry.
No, Peter Jones. Right, time to talk with today's special guest, the historian, writer, and broadcaster, Anna Kay.
Thank you.
So Anna Kay, now, it is Anna Kay, not Key.
Yes, it is.
And how fantastic to have written a book about an anarchic period in British history when you're Anna Kay in the UK, basically.
Yeah. So it's sort of like we are definitely the first to make that gag.
No one
has never heard that one
no.
before,
never been done.
Ever.
No. Never been done.
But and I have to say I'm very excited about you coming on today because we were just saying, I was looking for a book about this period. Someone recommended it on Blue Sky social media, and bought it and just loved it so much. I told Matt about it. That we absolutely have to get you on,
because
it's a history book, but it's every page is thrilling.
Oh, that's a pretty nice bit of feedback. Yeah.
You know, and so even if you think this is, you know, this you're not interested in this particular period, you have to get this book because it's brilliant and it's such an easy read. But also, you feel as though you're a better person at the end of it because you now know more stuff. What was it about? Now, you're the director of the Landmark Trust. That's what you do.
Yeah.
But you're a historian and a writer and a broadcaster. What made... So the full title of the book is The Restless Republic, Britain Without a Crown. Matt, just describe the cover just before we go any further.
So yellow and grey are the main yes. colours here. And we've got people chopping down the... Well, I'm going to say, is this the Royal Oak? Is this the tree which in which we have Charles is up there in that tree? And that's the sort of metaphor for it. They're trying to pull it down with ropes and axes.
Yeah, and if you look at the tree closely, you can see there's a crown and a shield in it. So, yeah, it's the tree of state or the tree of monarchy being hacked down.
And you know this is class because not only is the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction mentioned in the top corner, but also the Paul Roger Duff Cooper Prize is mentioned at the bottom, and then the Restless Republic.
I imagine that's
the crown.
Paul Roger Duff Cooper Prize.
Oh, right.
Yes. Paul Roger's champagne, and Duff Cooper is the name of the prize.
Clearly, your class showing through again. Oh, my goodness. Me and Cromwell on the same page.
There you go.
Yeah.
So this is such an extraordinary period. Loads and loads of historians have kind of looked at it, but you start at the beginning, Anna, by saying this book was born out of ignorance. So just explain why you wanted to write about this essentially extraordinary decade, this convulsion in British history.
Well, I suppose I felt, like maybe other people do, I suspect quite a lot of us do, that it was a sort of lost decade in history, in my experience. That is to say, you know, we know that there was a civil war and Charles I was executed, and then there was a bit when there wasn't the king, and then the restoration of the monarchy happened and history charged on. And I suppose I just felt like... That what was that like? I mean, the thought that all of that would happen and that people would be around in England, people who we might like feel quite familiar with from history, like Samuel Pepys or Christopher Wren or whatever, who didn't just kind of pop up into existence at the point of the restoration of the monarchy, but they saw it all happening. They saw the king being taken out onto the street in Whitehall on a January day and being beheaded, the monarchy being abolished, the House of Lords being abolished, the Church of England being completely transformed, royal lands being sold, crown jewels being melted down. So I suppose I came at it. I mean, I worked quite a lot on this like century, but I felt like I really didn't understand what all of that was, either completely what it was about, but also more importantly, I suppose, what it was like to experience. And I was kind of conscious. I started writing it when, do you remember all the meaningful votes and everything that happened around Brexit in Parliament?
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I had in my mind, like, it was a very, kind of dislocating time because, you know, lots of change was happening. And I was thinking this is all quite disconcerting. But it was nothing compared to what it was like to live through all this stuff in the 17th century. So, yeah, so I suppose I thought I don't want to jump over this anymore. I want to explore it more and see if I can make sense of it and make it come alive.
I cannot even begin to imagine the amount of research that goes into... I mean, literally every single page is awash with original source material, great quotes. You feel as though you actually are part of the 1650s, but it's always been written about, and you talk about it. It's often described as the interregnum, which implies a sort of... It was a blip, really, before the true path of monarchy was re-established, which sort of implies an inevitability in the flow of history, which reading this book doesn't really feel like that at all.
Yeah, because, of course, you know, we know now that the monarchy was going to be restored, and a lot of what was done in 1649 was, you know, undone later. But they didn't know that at the time. And as far as anybody knew in 1649, you know, monarchy and all of these institutions, you know, bishops, the crown itself, the House of Lords, everything was gone forever. And that's what they expected to happen. So, I thought that was something that is really easy to kind of have hindsight when you look back at the past and to say, oh, well, this didn't come to anything, therefore we shouldn't be interested in it. But actually, it was our revolution.
Yes.
And understanding why it happened and why what worked and what didn't and why it didn't last seemed to me to be, yeah, just really, really interesting.
We follow, I think it's 9 characters. Some of them are at the heart of this story. Some of them are at the periphery of the story. Tell us why you approached it through this this kind of gallery of rogues, for want of a better phrase.
I suppose a couple of reasons. So, you know, my memory of this period, insofar as I studied it when I was at school and so on, is of just a kind of terrible sea of things called, you know, things called the Grand Remonstrance and the Long Parliament and stuff, and finding it all pretty difficult to get your head around, and lots of battles. And I thought, I want to try and write this in a way that makes it easy to get into and where you have a sense of what the experience of it was like, number one. And then number two, it's because it's a period that was born out of a war and there were, you know, definite sides, I didn't want it to be a book which was like, you know, arguing for the royalists or for the parliamentarians, because, you know, as we know with politics now, you know, yes, there are allegiances, but actually life's about so much more than that. And then lots of people don't really have any allegiance. They've got other things to do. So I thought a way of escaping the kind of risk that you became a sort of protagonist from one side or another was to take different people as your vantage point who had different kind of concerns and allegiances. So I wanted to try and see whether I could get from the beginning, you know, from the moment when the king is executed to the moment when the republic ends, to travel that decade in the company of a series of people who lived through it, so that you would get from the beginning to the end, so you kind of understand what happened, but so you'd see what it was like to live through from different positions. So I tried to think about, could I find a series of people where we know enough about their lives that I could really try and kind of be next to them, but also that they represented different experiences. So like men and women, people of different social standings, not just lots of people in London, but, you know, people who were in, you know, the Isle of Man or in Cornwall or in Norfolk, and then people in different sort of social spheres. So, yeah, so that's what I thought. And I just think, I don't know, I find history always easier to understand when seen through a human lens.
I think you're absolutely right to put it through that lens, through these characters, because someone like me who came to this book who didn't know anything about the Civil War, there's no doubt you're going to be a little daunted, because you're thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a whole lot of words I'm not going to understand. But when you're telling the story through those characters, it all comes to life. I want to talk to you about 2 of those characters. So here's the thing. There are so many stories in this book that could be made into a movie. And so I'm going to pick on 2, which I think would absolutely work as movies. One is The Countess of Derby and The Isle of Man. The other is Anna Trapnell?
Trapnell, yeah.
Trapnell. I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave it as vague as I can. Talk to us about those 2 particular characters, because the stories they are involved in and the impact they have is amazing. And obviously, I had no idea who these women were before I picked up your book, but goodness me, what characters you've alighted on.
Yes, yeah, no, I felt that too. And people who know this period quite well don't necessarily know that much about these 2 because they're not people to the fore. But yeah, so Charlotte, Countess of Derby, was a sort of royalist battle axe. And when the royalists lost the Civil War, England, mainland England, was in the hands of the parliamentarians, but the other bits of the kingdoms of Charles I weren't. And one of those bits was the Isle of Man. And by the early 1650s, when the Republic has come into being in London, the Isle of Man is still held for the royalists by the kind of long-standing sort of overlords of the Isle of Man, who were the Earls of Derby. And Charlotte, Countess of Derby, is the wife of the Earl of Derby. And so they have a kind of little mini kind of rebel island in the middle of the Irish Sea, which is the Isle of Man, and hold court there. And all these royalists who've sort of, you know, been, you know, squeezed out by the military victory on the mainland hold up there. And I mean, there were sorts of interesting things about it, but there's a very great sort of moment of drama when the Charles I's son, who we know as Charles II, has a go at trying to kind of grab England back or Britain back. And he lands in the mainland and famously ends up at the Battle of Worcester, after which he hides up the oak tree, which mm-hmm. is one of our stories we all know. And Charlotte, Countess of Derby, and her husband try to join in with this. And the Earl of Derby goes to join Charles II, and Charlotte holds the Isle of Man. And essentially what happens is that the Charles II is completely unsuccessful. He loses the Battle of Worcester. He goes on the run. Eventually he gets away. The Earl of Derby is caught, and Charlotte is holding the Isle of Man. And she doesn't know that he's been executed, because of course the messages have to get across the sea, and a royal parliamentarian army is sent to take the island, and she herself, she's a 50-year-old woman, tough as old boots, a stronger hearted person than most men half her age, and she holds the island to the very, very last, until the siege cannons are basically about to fire, and then there's a mutiny among her people, and the whole thing collapses. But it's an extraordinary story of, first of all, what this period of huge political tension does in terms of bringing out people's character and roles and so on. But just the physical bravery of the enterprise. What the kind of consequences were of all of this for a series of individual people in this case.
And they try to bargain with her at one point, the parliamentarians, and she rips it up in front of them. I mean, that's in the trailer right there, ripping it up in front of them. I don't care if you kill me, kill my kids, kill the people within these castle walls. I'm not agreeing to that. I'm not compromising.
Exactly. Boom. She stands on the ramparts and she tears into strips the terms that she sent. And eventually, when she has to surrender, because there's just guns and her, she makes a point of signing the articles of surrender without reading a single word to say, I may be doing this, but don't think that I'm giving up. So it's an amazing story, and actually there's an incredible codicil to it, because the Isle of Man, which she then loses, is given to Thomas Fairfax, who's the head of the New Model Army, as a kind of gift. He's in retirement at this stage because he's kind of bowed out of the radicalism of the Republic. And he quietly arranges for all the income from the island to be paid to her, which is on the other side. So, I mean, it just goes to show that the kind of caricatures of this side, that side, polar opposites are not, they don't bear close inspection. Life's more complicated, more subtle, more human than that.
Before you tell us about Anna Chapnall, which is Matt's other choice, can you just do a bit more on that side of the leniency, which people will be surprised about, not just from Fairfax, but also Charles II. When he comes back in at the Restoration, it's not marked with revenge, and it's something that you comment on a number of times in the book. So before we do our fifth monarchist friend, can you just do a little bit about whether you were surprised as well about the leniency and forgiveness which seemed to be around?
Yeah, I mean, for anybody who's read up on or is interested in the Tudor period, one of the things that's surprising about this period is, for all the sort of fire and brimstone of the Puritans and Cromwell and the Civil War and everything, it's a much less kind of retributive, if that's a word, kind of environment and atmosphere than you get a century before. So actually, it's fascinating that things like executions, there are really very few of them. I mean, the Earl of Derby is executed, but he's one of only a really small number of royalists who are. And Oliver Cromwell himself argued against the execution of the Earl of Derby, and it seems to have happened really because of people in his own locality who were furious about what he did during the Civil War, who kind of push it through. And similarly, when it gets to the Restoration, there's been various books, and actually Robert Harris's book is one of them, about the kind of hunting down of the people who signed Charles I's death warrant. But actually, in the end, the number of people who are executed are no more than a handful. Even though 60 people signed the death warrant, far fewer than that are executed. All the Cromwells are completely fine. Then Henry Cromwell, Richard Cromwell, and there's no sort of chasing up of them or putting them to the sword. And actually, one of the most dramatic things that happens at the Restoration is that the corpses of Oliver Cromwell and two of the other figures of the Republic are dug up and executed in, posthumously, which is really gruesome. But of course, they were already dead.
They were already dead.
So, you know, it serves a wonderful kind of like sense of, you know, revenge drama purpose. But Charles II was really clear that he, you know, there'd been enough of this. He didn't want to see more of it. And, you know, this thing about an act of oblivion, which both the Republicans passed themselves in the mid-1650s and Charles II does the same thing at the Restoration, is saying, we're just going to draw a line under all of this. We're not going to be chasing after everybody and, you know, hunting them down other than a very small number. And actually the kind of, you know, particularly after war, I think the appetite for just, you know, peace and moving on is very strong. And it's a real tonic to the sort of, you know, the thirst for vengeance, which other people feel.
And Anna, so tell us about our fifth monarchist, Anna Trapmore, because this is another one of those characters, which is why I think your book is so addictive, because you think, OK, I thought I knew a little bit about this period. I've never heard of these people, but they have extraordinary stories to tell.
Yes. So Anna Trapnell's a fascinating figure. She's a young woman in her late 20s into her 30s in the period where we encounter her. And she was daughter of a shipwright. So she's not, you know, a countess or, you know, a politician or anything like that. She grows up in London. And she became a member of one of the new religious groups that come into being during this period because of essentially a bit of a greater freedom about worship and a kind of questioning of the like single view of the church, which had always been in place. And she became a member of a group that are called the Fifth Monarchists, who haven't stood the test of time, but they were very sort of powerful or very popular group in the mid-17th century. And she really came to the fore because she started having visions. So she would experience a sort of lightheadedness, fall into a kind of a trance, and she would see God or see a kind of vision which God featured. And when she woke up, she'd remember what happened and she'd tell people. This came to be real kind of front page news in this period because the Civil War was essentially a war about religion, about what sort of form of religion there should be in the country. And those on the Puritan end espouse the form of religion where it's really about your direct relationship with God. It's not about priests mediating and telling you what to think. It's you and God, one to one. And so everyone was very concerned to know what God thought and whether, you know, whose side he was on and so on. And this sort of form of understanding of like your relationship with God meant that people could, you know, would be listened to who said God came to me and told me this, because that's, you know, had a kind of credibility which it hadn't had in the past. Anna Trapmore started having visions, which had a really uncanny sort of habit of turning out to happen. So she had a vision about the Rump Parliament being dismissed, which is something that happened in 1653, and 4 days later, you know, something that was, you know, identifiably what she had foreseen happened. And so she becomes suddenly a kind of prophetess, not of her own. She's not trying to kind of promote herself. She's just a sort of person who has these strange experiences. But suddenly she's sort of pounced upon by those who want to say, aha, look, you know, this, she said this, so therefore this is going to happen. Or she's, to begin with, she said things which were made, you know, sort of as it was sort of supportive of Cromwell and his circle. And then she has visions in which he's turned malevolent and they say, oh, this is a sign that God's turned against Cromwell. So it's an amazing thing because this young woman, this, you know, of a kind of, you know, no social standing, but quite self-composed and a very interesting figure because she kind of grows as a person and you see what happens to her, becomes somebody who has tremendous influence because of what she sees. I won't give the kind of tale away, but what happens to her and how she kind of turns the tables on those who are trying to use her as a political tool is a kind of fascinating element of this story and something that I really don't think would have happened in this way in another age. I mean, I think it's one of the things, the role of women in this period is really interesting, come to the fore in all sorts of ways, which we, you know, don't see in the decades before.
Was there a story or a character which you came across in the writing of this book which made you excited, which you thought, hang on, I'm really onto something here?
Oh, well, kind of all of them, really. I got really, really absorbed in. And I mean, one of my characters is Oliver Cromwell, because I just felt you couldn't write a book about this period without having him. And he's obviously, that's grand, that's pretty well covered in other books. So although I felt I got to know him, I didn't think I was turning up some sort of amazing original cache of documents that no one had looked at. But with all the other people, I felt that I was really getting to something which hadn't been said before, hadn't been explored before. And then there were specific moments of kind of revelation, like, for example, George Monk, who is the the soldier in the Cromwellian army, the officer general in the Cromwellian army, who's the one who in the end turns the army on itself and brings the Republic to an end. Really getting to know him and realising that his wife, who actually was clearly the person who was influencing him to act in this way, because he was very conservative, and someone he had met when he was a prisoner in the Tower of London, he's the son of a knight, she's the washerwoman, so it's an amazing, yeah, you know, alliance. Very obviously genuine love relationship. But that discovering that they, although they were married, she was already married and her husband was still alive, which he was. And he had been prepared to risk everything, pay off the husband, park him somewhere else in order to be able to marry her because he loved her. And then you begin to understand how somebody who would be prepared to do something really risky because you could be executed for bigamy might then, in another context, i.e. the business of intervening in a way that brought the Republic to an end, be prepared to do something incredibly risky if they thought that right was on their side.
The number of times in this book where someone does something very, very risky, it's very easy for us looking back on it and think, well, there's not much jeopardy here at all because we know what happens. But at the time, they had no clue. You talked about Cromwell there. I realised how little I knew of this time. As I was getting towards the end of the book, I thought, I don't know how Cromwell dies. And I was like, is he executed? And then I remembered from when we read Act of Oblivion, his body had been dug up and all dreadful things done to it, and obviously in your book we talk about how he died. I'm struck by what you said very early on in this interview, that you were writing this in 2019 around about the time of the meaningful votes about Brexit, because Cromwell a number of times claims to be speaking on behalf of the people, and this is the will of the people. And yet, when it comes to killing the king, of having Charles I executed, you talk in the book about how that is not popular at all. Also, him getting rid of the rump parliament and replacing them with appointees, the very definition of not the will of the people. And it's only come to me now just because of you saying you were talking about it at a time, or writing about this at a time when we were being told this is the will of the people. I'm not going to make this into a Brexit thing, but 52-48, will of the people, everyone wants this, meaningful votes. The aligning of those two parts of history coming together when you're writing this book is alarming.
Yeah, and you know, that was really, I mean, I don't draw the reference in the book, not least because I think it'll date, but when I was writing it, totally ringing in my ears, because there were all those conversations about, you know, to what extent did the representatives in Parliament represent the will of the people, which, as we know, on the Brexit issue, you know, there wasn't a majority in Parliament for Brexit when the thing went through, or to what extent is there a different kind of will of the people that is expressed in a different way? And that I mean, on different kind of bases, exactly that tension existed in the 17th century, because on the one hand, you have what the MPs want, putting aside the fact that hardly anyone was allowed to vote and, you know, other things, only men, etc. But nonetheless, you know, you had a House of Commons, which was made of representatives. And then the kind of other view of whether what they said actually did represent the will of the people. And one of the ironies of this period, and I say it as someone who has a lot of time for Oliver Cromwell, and I admire him in lots of ways, but the idea that he's in any way a Democrat, if you like, is just for the birds. I mean, and it makes me smile always seeing that statue, actually wonderful statue of him outside Westminster Hall in London, because him standing there like the defender of Parliament. I mean, it's the irony of it. I mean, he marched into the House of Commons on, you know, more than one occasion with soldiers, or was responsible for that similar thing happening, to boot them out because they hadn't decided what he thought should happen. And the crucial thing for him, of course, as it was for others at the time, was the thing that really mattered was what God thought. So it's not so much that Cromwell, I think, is sort of, you know, determined to impose what he as a human being feels should happen, and that's more important than what the representatives of the people say. It's that ultimately all of this is sort of nothing compared to what God wants, and that's where Cromwell's interests lay. So if actually a House of Commons didn't come up with what he wanted, then, you know, then his job was to bring about a change. So it's a really, it's a really interesting thing. And again, going back to why I wanted to write it from different people's point of views, because I don't think it just comes down to a kind of they're these guys who think this, they're these guys who think that, these are royalists, these are Republicans, and, you know, it's two views of the world, because it is not as simple as that. And, you know, human beings aren't, and it's and that complexity is part of what makes everyone more interesting and it all much richer.
And if you're wondering whether Ireland is part of this story, the answer to that is very much yes, and the savagery of what happened in Ireland and Drogheda and all those kind of, is definitely part of this story. But as you said, other people have covered that. So I think the interesting thing is what I think we're concentrating on is the stuff that we haven't been a part of before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you started from ignorance. We started with a far higher greater of ignorance. So you're charting the course in this decade through monarchy, republic, parliamentary commonwealth, military protectorate. And as you said at the beginning, we kind of view this, oh, well, and then the monarchy came back. When you were studying this period, was there a time, is there a sequence of events that you could see whereby the republic could have succeeded and become permanent?
Yes, I don't think that that was an impossibility at all. I think that it was always unstable because the decision was made to execute Charles I before any agreement, this is another irony, before any agreement was come to about what was the better system you were going to have instead. So it's that kind of, it's very easy to agree on what you don't like, but you know, is there more agreement on what you want instead? So that always made it fragile because that finding a kind of alternative arrangement that people were happy with was difficult. But I think the kind of crucial moment where there was a sort of fork in the road was when Oliver Cromwell was dying, and the terms of the constitution, which there was a written constitution at that time, unlike now, meant that Cromwell could choose his successor. Now, if he had chosen, he ended up choosing his oldest son, Richard, which is fascinating because it's, you know, ultimately a very, very traditional thing to do. And Cromwell, in many ways, was a very traditional person socially and in other ways. He was a sort of gentleman farmer from East Anglia. But it meant that he handed on this complicated, you know, tangle of problems to somebody who was completely unprepared for it and not very suited to the task. I think, for example, if at that moment he had passed it instead to his second son called Henry Cromwell, who was in charge of Ireland after the Civil War and who actually had made a remarkably good job of what was obviously a catastrophic set of circumstances there, then I think it might well have endured. I think it might well have endured. And I think if, you know, it's really interesting how much in the end people, individuals and personalities really do count. So I think that could have seen the whole thing kind of grow roots that would have made it last. But he'd, you know, Oliver Cromwell, because again, he's always looking up, you know, will God judge me if I make the wrong decision here? He doesn't make choices that are necessarily about stability and political, you know, savviness. They're other motivations.
One of our previous guests talked, had written a book, a fictional book, with its roots in the Greek Civil War. And one of the characters in that book said something along the lines of, why can't we be more like the English who had their civil war and then a few years later, everything was fine? And it struck me reading that book then, but also reading your book, that, you know, you look at other countries around the world who've had a civil war, and the obvious example here is the US, where the tentacles from that, from hundreds of years ago, they're still stretching out across the United States now, and they are making themselves felt in their politics still now. Whereas the English Civil War, I think you make the point at one point that a visitor from overseas within 10 years of the end of the Civil War would not have known. Or rather, from 10 years from Cromwell dying and the monarchy being restored, would not have known that there had been a civil war in this country. What do you think is at the root of that? That this country seems to have got through it and then it's all fine, and other countries, those waves are still lapping at the shores?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So my kind of response to that would be that our republic was constitutionally a failure. That's, you know, self-evidently the case. We saw a coronation this year. We still have a monarchy. Mm. But I think that really masks a lot about how the experiences and changes of that decade got into the bloodstream of the nation in a way that brought about really fundamental changes that made the sort of political system and the kind of the sort of social structures and so on in this country kind of reformed them over time. So lots of the things that were kind of experimented with or aired for the first time in this decade, even though at the Restoration there might have been a reversion, but within 50 years they've become, you know, they've become commonplace. So, for example, something like the freedom of the press, for example, which in the 1640s and into the 1650s, a massive explosion. Newspapers are suddenly being published. Books, readership and publication goes off the scale. Censorship is reinstituted in 1660, but by the end of the century, it's gone. And the Licensing Act lapses and anyone can publish, not quite anything, but it's much freer. Or religious toleration. Again, in this period, this 10 years, for the very first time in so post-Christian English history and British history, that you are allowed a little bit not to worship the same way as everybody else. You know, there isn't, there are people like Anna Trapnell, the fifth monarchist, who are allowed to meet and worship. You wouldn't, that wasn't permitted before. So for the very first time in British history, there is a kind of an acknowledgement that not everybody has to worship the same way, and toleration is a good thing. And then again, by the end of the 17th century, the Toleration Act has passed and religious toleration is everywhere. And there's a whole series of other things. The idea that Parliament, or rather the House of Commons, is the sovereign body. Now, the idea was floated and then it was kind of overridden in the way that we've talked about on occasion. But nonetheless, this was a kind of quite a novel concept. And again, by the end of the century, when William of Orange accedes to the English throne, it's a kind of contractual arrangement. He has to agree to listen to Parliament, have it meet a certain amount of times, and so on. And the Bill of Rights is passed. So in a whole series of ways, I think, although if you just have a frame of reference, which is to 1660, you'd think, oh, well, it's all undone. So what was the point of that? But I think if you open your kind of lens a bit wider and you look to the end of the century, and there's other stories to how this happens, but nonetheless, lots and lots of the kind of innovations and reforms and kind of modernizations, if you like, of this decade become part of like kind of national, you know, arrangements. And that helps kind of resolve a lot of things, which in, say, for example, France, you know, the French Revolution, in a way, is the expression of the fact that lots of these things are still unresolved.
We should learn this at school, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Everyone, this should be part of the core. How is it possible that the English Civil War is not part of the English curriculum?
It's amazing, isn't it? And my kids, who are 15, despite these GCSEs, got twins, and they have been doing English history, and I think they did something like 1 week on the Civil War, which was exactly as I remember it. It was a terrible sea of, you know, the grand remonstrance and the humble petition advice, and their eyes swam, and you know, it needs proper time.
They need to read their mum's book. That's
I know,
what,
yeah, exactly. One day, who knows?
What are you going to work on next, Anna? Because, as I said before, the amount of research for this must have blown your mind.
Well, there was a lot. There was a lot. But actually, because I write it about nine individuals, that gives you some kind of parameters around it, which helps to direct your energies and so on. So, yeah, it does take a lot of research. And I do love the kind of history that I love writing is where it's, you know, it's not kind of repeating what other people said. It's straight from the, you know, the letters, the diaries, the, you know, the original material. But yes. Oh, so I've started work on a new book, which is all about how life in England became internationalised from the Tudor period to the Civil War. So it's about England's sudden encounter of the whole of the rest of the world, pre-empire, but after the Reformation, and what that was like. And yeah, that's what I'm working on.
It sounds like a lot of hard work.
Sounds like pirates, am I right?
Do you know, there are really quite a lot of pirates. Yeah, no, there'll be plenty of pirates.
Is that like the beginning of empire then?
Well, it is, except I would sort of challenge that, because I think a bit like talking about the Civil War, we think of it from the vantage point of what happens later, which is empire. But nobody knew this empire was going to become a thing. This is about how traders, cloth traders, adventurous people who've got things to sell or are curious about the world, start getting in ships and bobbing out across terrifyingly, you know, uncertain waters, and what makes them do it, and how thrilled and excited they are about what they find when they get there. So I want to kind of, it's a story about forget what happens later, which is another story, you know, undo that kind of hindsight and think about what, you know, to explore what it was like if you're a Tudor, you know, wool merchant, and suddenly your boat is on, you know, the shores of Africa.
Well, we'll look forward to that because we're a bit late being on the Restless Republic. So when will that be out?
A couple of years.
Okay, all fine. Right. In which case, that's fine. Will you? But you must come back anyway.
I'd love to.
Anna Kay's book is The Restless Republic. It's absolutely thrilling. You must buy at least a couple of copies. That's what you should do. We'll talk more with Anna in our second podcast where she'll do the Q&A. But for the moment, Anna Kay, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.